Linda Moulton Howe will be with us for 2 hours tonight. She is an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, and author, and she has been chasing this honeybee story now for some time. It is a very strange story, Linda. Welcome back.
Well, thanks, George. And, you know, in my previous February 23rd coast, I had news updates about the mysterious honeybee disappearances, mm-hmm. and I interviewed a Pennsylvania honeybee keeper who has had now nearly 2,000 of his 2,900 hives disappear. No bodies around the hives, in the hives, in the boards of the hives, and it is now for him a 60% loss to date. And that was David Hackenberg of Hackenberg Apiary in Pennsylvania. He said that he had never seen so many deserted hives in his 45-year career raising bees, and that it was the first time that he had ever seen predator moths and beetles leave the hives completely alone. And that's why he suspects that some kind of pesticide is getting into the flower pollen and the nectar and poisoning the hives. It's not proved, but that's his gut feeling, and mm-hmm. he contacted Penn State's bee experts to investigate. And, George, here we are at March 16th, a little less than a month since that last report, and to date there is no answer.
That's what's so incredible about all of this, Linda. This is going on and on and on, and they don't know what's going on.
Exactly. And, George, the bees are still disappearing. I've been on phones with beekeepers in Texas, beekeepers in Oklahoma, Ohio, all over the place. And as of this month, as of this date, honey beekeepers in the colder latitudes, for example, of Ohio and Pennsylvania, have just begun to reopen their hives, and they are finding continuing devastating losses. Up to 80% in wow. one of the beekeepers in Ohio just this past week. And in the Oklahoma-Ohio area, I talked with a beekeeper tonight. And get this, 13,000 healthy bee colonies he had in mid-November. December 10th, for completely mysterious reasons, his colonies began disappearing. And today, March 16th, from December 10th to March 16th, 96%.
Oh, my God. 3 months. Boom.
96% of all his bees have disappeared. And he told me tonight, with his voice cracking, Linda, I'm facing bankruptcy, and I'm not the only beekeeper, and what's going to happen? Well, not only is it now 24 or 25 or 26 states, depending upon Bee Alert's map as it goes up and down with new reports in the United States, internationally in Poland and Spain, there are disappearances, and the answers are still unknown right now about how many more honeybees will be gone as more northern hives are opened this spring in North America and Europe. Right now, dozens of scientists are trying to find out what is causing what they call colony collapse disorder, or CCD. And today at Penn State, when I talked with Mr. Van Engelsdorp, who is in the kind of at the center of all this research, he said, this is an emergency. This is an emergency. Now, I also talked with Penn State entomologist Diana Cox Foster, Ph.D., who has analyzed some bees found in deserted hives. And Dr. Cox Foster has seen as many as five different viruses and unidentified fungi in these bees. And she told me that this is at least two times more the number of pathogens than she has ever seen before in honeybees. And the implication is that something has seriously damaged their immune systems, leaving the honeybees more vulnerable to disease than before. But what could that be? So far, there still are no answers, but there is a long list of possibilities, which include pesticides and genetically modified crops, also known as GMOs or GMs. Now, the scientists I've talked to all over the country, they stress that there is no direct evidence that genetically modified crops are linked to honeybee die-offs. But I have been learning that not much is known at all about the accumulating impact of pesticides on insects, animals, and even people. When you consider in this modern world how many combinations of pesticides are now used, one pesticide by itself might not destroy honeybees, but what happens when farmers spray herbicides, fungicides, insecticides, and rodenticides on land that also has genetically modified crops with pesticides built in? The United States grows nearly two-thirds of all genetically engineered crops. Last year, about 130 million acres were planted with GMs. Much of the soy, corn, cotton, and canola have had a gene inserted into their DNA to produce pesticides systemically throughout the plants, and this is created and patented by Monsanto. Monsanto also produces genetically modified crops designed not to die when herbicides are sprayed on them. And in a perfect biotech world, only the weeds would be killed. But Mother Nature has a way of outwitting human designs. And now they're finding that the weeds are becoming resistant to the herbicide sprays, and frustrated farmers are putting on more and more poisons. How much is too much? One American plant pathologist who is very concerned about the herbicide-resistant weeds is Doug Gurian-Sherman, Ph.D., now a senior scientist in the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C. Previously, between 1995 and 2000, Dr. Gurian-Sherman was a staff scientist at the Environmental Protection Agency, where he evaluated risks and safety of pesticides and genetically modified crops. I asked him earlier this week about the possible impact of accumulating pesticides on honeybees.
It's hard to know what the ramification might be for bees, but one of the two main types of genetically engineered crops, and the one most widely planted in the U.S. and around the world, are herbicide-tolerant crops, and especially herbicide-tolerant soybeans. At least 85, probably a higher percentage, of the soybeans in the U.S. are resistant to a particular type of herbicide called glyphosate. The trade name of the most common type is called Roundup. And what this trait does is allows a farmer to spray the herbicide right on the crop, which would have killed the crop, would have killed the soybeans prior to the introduction of this gene. The gene comes from a type of bacteria that is found in the soil, and it makes the plant basically immune to the herbicide. The consequence of this is that glyphosate and Roundup, which is sold by Monsanto, which also sells the seed of the type of soybeans that are immune or resistant to the herbicide, that herbicide has become the most widely used herbicide now in the world. And the consequence of that is you have one particular herbicide that's used on a tremendous amount of acreage in the U.S. and elsewhere, especially Argentina and Brazil. As any biologist would expect, when you have such tremendous pressure on weeds to try to survive this herbicide, some of the weeds that are resistant, all their competition is basically killed off, and these resistant weeds then proliferate and can no longer be controlled by glyphosate. So now you have a situation where the use of this herbicide has gone up, and on probably millions of acres, other herbicides are having to be used as well as glyphosate in order to control the resistant weeds. So what we've been seeing in the last few years is the overall level of herbicide use increasing on these crops, and it will almost inevitably continue to increase. And in this case, causing the rise of these resistant weeds and the increased use of herbicides, and potentially maybe harming amphibians to boot.
And the honeybees, and with the creation of these Frankenstein crops and Frankenstein weeds, isn't emerging a major question about the accumulation, that no one really knows the answer to how much is too much for Earth life, and that the piling on of herbicides now against resistant weeds made resistant through the application of genetically modified herbicides, you are increasing pesticides out there in the world with unknown consequences?
Well, certainly when the Environmental Protection Agency registers pesticides, it does quite a bit of testing. But even though that testing does reveal potential risks and does have a lot of value, it certainly also has substantial limits. And one of those limits is that we really don't often have a good handle on how the interaction between different pesticides can affect organisms. And that's really not considered or tested by EPA.
Another bee expert at the University of California in Davis has discovered that some EPA-approved fungicides that don't kill adult honeybees do kill bee larvae and young bees. Eric Musson, Ph.D., is an entomologist and extension apiculturist at UC Davis. He is concerned that some EPA approval criteria only applies to adult honeybees and does not protect the young.
If you have something like a fungicide which doesn't hurt an adult bee when it's sprayed with it or hits it in the field, then they just think it's safe for honeybees. And in some cases, that hasn't been the truth. Not too long ago, I ran some experiments in the lab and found out that two of the fungicides that are commonly used out here for controlling diseases on the almond trees, if you got too much of it into the larval food of honeybees, it killed the larvae.
And the bottom line is that currently the Environmental Protection Agency has testing regulations that are applied to the adult bee, but you're finding that those levels that EPA accepts are killing the brood and the young bees.
Well, that's only happened in a few chemicals, but I guess the answer to that is yes. And what we were hoping would be that there would also have to be some kind of data generated before a registration was processed that talked about what happened if it got into the food of the immatures.
Now, when you explained the research that you did and what you found to EPA, what did EPA say?
Well, they said they wanted to see some evidence or some data, so I sent them the evidence, and I cannot see that anything has changed since that. And that was a couple of years ago.
In the past 6 years, a new group of nicotine-based pesticides have emerged called neonicotinoids. The most common is imidacloprid. Ironically, these were originally manufactured to be less lethal. But about 4 years ago, French and Italian beekeepers complained that imidacloprid crop spraying was killing their honeybees. So the French and Italian governments banned the nicotine-based pesticides. American scientists now studying the colony collapse disorder wrote in their first preliminary report that even though the neonicotinoids will not kill adult bees directly on flowers and plants, lab research shows, quote, if bees are eating fresh or stored pollen contaminated with these chemicals at low levels, the pesticides might not cause mortality, but might impact the bee's ability to learn or make memories. If this is the case, young bees leaving the hives to make orientation flights might not be able to learn the location of the hive and might not be returning, causing the colonies to dwindle and eventually die, unquote. I asked Jerry Hayes, chief of the apiary section for Florida's Department of Agriculture in Gainesville, about the nicotine-based pesticide's ability to disable honeybee memory.
The interesting thing about the colony collapse disorder is, of course, bees are leaving the colony and not coming back, which is highly unusual for a social insect to leave a queen and its brood or its young behind. So they seemingly are going out, can't find their way back home. The imidacloprid, when it's used to control termites, does exactly the same thing. One of the methods it uses to kill termites is that the termites feed on this material and then go out to feed and can't remember how to get home. And then it also causes their immune system to collapse, causing what would be normal organisms to become pathogenic in them.
Have farmers been using imidacloprid more than they have in the past?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think its use has changed. First, it started out as a seed treatment to protect the seed as it germinated and developed. Now it's being used as a foliar spray. It's being used as a systemic. It's being combined with fungicides, which increases its efficacy. And so its use has changed, and especially systemically, it does what it's supposed to do. It takes care of agricultural pests, which we want it to do, but there seems to be a disconnect sometimes that researchers and horticulturists forget that a honeybee is an insect. Then, of course, there are other insects out there that are valuable pollinators as well. So systemically, this material is found in the nectar, in many cases in low doses, not something that would kill a honeybee. So the question is, what does chronic exposure to the honeybee as an adult, or as the bees bring this material back to the nest to store and feed to developing young bees over time, what does chronic exposure do to the colony?
And Dennis Hayes told me that the National Academy of Sciences is very concerned about the decline of all North American pollinators and what could happen to the United States food supply if we can't stop pollinators from disappearing. And he spoke about this before an Academy meeting in Washington, D.C. last year, George, and we'll hear more about this in the next half hour.
Linda, you've covered a lot of stories of high strangeness. How would you push this one into the pile, way up there?
In terms of our Earth and the implications of the pollinators disappearing, George, this is really serious. As this other scientist told me today, this is an emergency.
And you know what? It's such a story of huge scope and magnitude, Linda. I'm amazed of the truly minimal coverage it gets on a national basis. Local stations are handling this in their particular states. But in terms of this being a major news story that should be scattered all over the media, it's not being done. Why is that?
When the anchors can't get their strawberries, when they can't get their apples, when they can't get the blueberries, whenever they can't get all of these foods that we love so much, then it will become relevant to putting on the 6 o'clock news. To me, right now is when it's crucial, because we're opening up hives around this nation. And if it's going to be 60, 70, 80, 96% empty, George, what does happen in 2007 with our food supply that the United States now is reaching out of our borders?
Linda will be right back with a second part of her report tonight. And then next hour, we'll keep her around for phone calls with Linda, not just restricting you to questions about the honeybees, though that's very important. We can talk about crop formations and some of the other stories Linda has investigated. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie in the cave for a little bit. Probably be here for about 4 weeks or so. There is nothing like springtime in St. Louis. Linda Moulton Howe with us, as she will be next hour as well. Linda, I'll let you pick up with your second half of your story.
Well, thanks, George. And a follow-up to Jerry Hayes' comments there in the end of the first half hour about those nicotine-based pesticides. There was another important finding about the unpredictable impact that combinations of pesticides can have, and it was discussed in the Colony Collapse Disorder Working Group's first preliminary report that was first published in December 15th of 2006. And it said, quote, a study in North Carolina found that some of the widely used neonicotinoids in combination with certain widely used fungicides, such as TerraGuard and Procure, synergized. That always means that two things come together and they create a much more dynamic situation. So that when the neonicotinoid and the fungicides come together, they synergize to increase the toxicity, which means the poison, the toxicity of the neonicotinoid over 1,000 times what it would be normally. And this was in laboratory studies, unquote. Now, that is a hugely important finding because it comes right down to the bottom line of how much is mixing together out there. between the systemic pesticides built in genetically in some of the GMO crops, the nicotine-based pesticides that are being used more and more and more all over the world, and all of the others, and that we have layers and layers of pesticides. Well, so far, scientists are in agreement that there is no direct evidence that genetically modified crops are linked in a direct way to honeybee die-off, but beyond the honeybees, George, something is killing all the pollinators, at least in North America.
That is bizarre. And Linda, let me ask you before you continue with your report. The scientists who say that they do not see the link with GM foods, are any of them, if you know, getting financing from any of the companies involved?
It's a very difficult and very, very touchy subject. In the last 6 weeks, as I've been getting deeper and deeper into this subject, I have had some people tell me that they would only talk to me about some subjects off the record.
Oh, my.
I have had some scientists get very angry at the implication that they would accept money from Monsanto or Novartis or any of the genetically modified patenting companies. But I've also talked with people, non-science people in Washington, in the, we'll call it the agency world of Washington, and they don't quibble. They say that there is no question that there is political pressure by companies that have a huge vested interest in the perpetuation of GMOs and the seeds and the herbicides. Monsanto not only makes the genetically modified seeds, it makes the herbicides that are supposed to kill the weeds in the genetically modified crops, and now the weeds are becoming resistant to the sprays, and you can see what a complex situation we've got on our hands.
They aggressively are cornering the market.
And maybe not to the good of people, plants, animals, or the world. I don't know, and tonight I don't want to be in any kind of a finger-pointing mode, because we've got a really serious subject, and it's trying to get to the facts and the pressure of facts. What is happening, and can it be changed so that the pollinators and the honeybees, which are part of the pollinators, can come back the way they were just a couple of decades ago?
Absolutely. So I'll let you continue. The company, of course, through its scientists, deny that the genetically modified foods might have anything to do with this. Go ahead.
Right. Now, the pollinators, of which honeybees we are talking about at the top of the list, also includes bumblebees, hornets, wasps, butterflies, hummingbirds, and even bats are considered pollinators. But something is happening in the environment that is causing all of those different species to decline. And currently, the most dramatic event is the massive disappearance of honeybees in North America, Spain, and Poland, and we'll see what else happens in Europe as the spring unfolds there. Well, I was talking about all this with Jerry Hayes, who's chief of the apiary section for Florida's Department of Agriculture in Gainesville. And he told me that he was asked a year ago to speak before the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C., about the serious decline of North American pollinators.
I was able to make a presentation to the National Academy of Sciences last year, and they produced a report about the loss of pollinators in North America. The federal government asked the National Academy of Sciences to look at this from a strategic standpoint. How much of our food production do we want to turn over to other countries that may be friendly now and not friendly in the future, similar to our energy production problems right now? So the federal government is looking at this, and my question is, are honeybees the canary in the coal mine? What are honeybees trying to tell us that we as humans should be paying more attention to? This is the most dramatic losses that I've seen in my career. I think I've heard 80% losses. I think they lost 400,000 colonies in Poland and 600,000 in Spain or something like that. We have about 280,000 colonies registered in the state of Florida. Of that, we're projecting a loss between 35 and 45% of those. What insects can you think of that man has a relationship with? There aren't too many. And honeybees have had a relationship with man for thousands of years. It has been beneficial to both species. And now that is highly in jeopardy.
Could we be looking at food shortages at the end of 2007?
I suppose if this continued, so then the question is, who fills in the gap and do we become reliant on them? I think I read a figure, the USDA projected by 2015 or something like that, that 40% of our vegetables would be coming from China. So the transition's already taking place, and what does this mean for consumers? If they can still get food in a grocery store and the price is the same, who cares about the honeybees?
But that comes back to your presentation at the National Academy of Sciences and the interests of national security. If we end up losing our pollinators in North America and we're dependent upon China, South America, and other countries that politically may become difficult in the future, what would happen to the U.S. food supply?
Exactly.
The Central Intelligence Agency had reported several years ago that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had a big grip on the honeybee industry in the Middle East and extending to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and that region of the world. Do you think there's any possibility that this honeybee disappearance could be related to some sort of bioterrorism on the part of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda?
Well, yeah, I don't know if those guys are smart enough to pull something like that off.
Did that issue ever come up on the record or off the record with the National Academy of Sciences?
Not that I remember. Certainly has gone through my mind.
Does it surprise you that since October of 2006, when the disappearance was becoming publicly reported and massive, that there still is not an answer by March of 2007?
Yes. We have a lot of incredibly smart people who know honeybees, who know toxicology, who know funguses and yeasts and what have you, working on this and analyzing this. And I would have thought that we would have had one of those aha moments of here it is. So when you don't have an aha moment, that tells me that it's something so brand new that we can't identify it, or that there are multiple things intersecting causing the problem.
And that's what I think is going to be unfolding over the next at least 3 or 4 weeks. I learned today, George, that there was a meeting yesterday in Washington, D.C. with all of the people that I've had on coast in February and March, and that it will be joined by a lot of other people, ranging from producers to beekeepers to more scientists. And that they had a meeting yesterday, and in that meeting they discussed that there now is congressional interest in the House Subcommittee on Agriculture for having a hearing on March 29th at the end of this month with the same group of scientists in the colony collapse disorder and bringing in a lot of other people, and that the subcommittee wants to hear by then what more statistics do they have over the next 2 weeks. And Be Alert Technologies now has at its website a survey for beekeepers to try to keep on a daily basis, all over the United States, they're asking for beekeepers to go to Bee Alert Technologies, fill out that survey as they are opening up the hives, those that have been in the northern climes, and to report as accurately as possible how many hives are empty or whatever the problems are, so that in 2 weeks they can present to the House subcommittee, here's what the picture looks like on March 30th. And right now, on the phone calls that I've had today, yesterday, the day before with beekeepers, trying to find out what are they learning as they're opening up, if they are in some parts of the country just opening up their hives for the first time, or if they have been pollinators going to California for the almond pollination.
Right.
What's been happening? And I really kind of hoped positively that I would start hearing it's stopping. I'm actually surprised at the almost near desperation that I have now heard in the voices of some of these beekeepers who are saying, Linda, when we had mites at the end of the 80s, and they would describe the situation, and the mites came in, and there was a lot of loss, but there were bodies. There were bodies in the bottoms of the hives. There were bodies around. As the man, one of the beekeepers, the one who has 13,000 healthy hives in mid-November, he told me tonight, he said, you have no idea how weird it is for me. He said, I've been doing beekeeping for 47 years. And he said, you go out and you look at the bottom of the hive, and he said, it's clean. Everything is clean. There's just no dead bodies. There's no signs of anything. He said, it's really eerie, and you're left with, I don't even know how to grab at this. Because he said, with mites, we at least were given guidance, and we said, okay, this is the problem. And so now we're going to come up with a way to deal with the mites. And he said, now it's like we're dealing with a ghost. The bees are disappearing, and we can't get our hands on why they are disappearing.
Linda, do we know if the bees are setting up colonies someplace else or if they're dying?
Well, there have been some bees found dead or dying inside of a few of the hives. Like there have been queens with some of the worker bees around them and little spots of bees, and that's what have gone to the University of Pennsylvania and Penn State and other places for examination. But the bottom line answer is, if you think, well, if there were thousands of bees in each hive and all of these hives are empty, where in the heck are all these bees?
Where are they going?
And why aren't we finding huge clusters of dead bees someplace? Well, this is part of this disappearing mystery. And when I asked, I said, I've been getting hundreds of emails from people all over in Canada, the United States, all over, even other parts of the world, saying everybody has an anecdote about I've found my swimming pool covered with bees, or that man who called in February and said that he had put some in a cup. They say they can't use any more samples than they have right now, and that right they are just overwhelmed with trying to do the work and try to come up with an answer. And so they're saying to everybody listening, if you have something, that there are local bee associations in every state. And at my website, earthfiles.com, I will have a report that has all of these links to all of these associations that you can communicate with. And it would be up right now, but I had a server problem tonight, and I was not able to interact with my server. But probably after the show and by the morning, that story will be up there with all of these links, so that for those of you who would like more information or would like to report something, I will have all of these links that you can go to. And another part of this whole story that is disturbing in this sense, that I was not so aware until I started trying to find out what is happening in this investigation of the honeybees, about how many layers of pesticides and herbicides and rodenticides and all of this there are out in the world. And that in this layering, as the UC Davis scientist explained, there our EPA, our FDA, and our USDA, and they all try to have standards, and they're supposed to test, and they're supposed to test whether some new pesticide is going to hurt, and then that's the question, hurt bees, hurt what? And when recently, as he stressed, that he in his own lab found that a fungicide that was EPA approved because it didn't acutely kill the adult honeybee, but killed the brood and the young bees, this is a red flag on all of this. How much stuff is being approved, not for any sinister reason, but just the whole overwhelming world right now, that regulations and getting things approved is a big deal. And if they say, well, if it doesn't kill off the adults and it doesn't get into the groundwater and it doesn't, and the list goes on. But what if it's killing the young? And what if some of this herbicide is seeping down into groundwater and coming into taps? Now, this is, comes to a story that I got today that comes through the office in an interview with the environment minister in Denmark. And they have just recently found out that water reservoirs are now showing up the herbicide of Roundup that we were talking about earlier.
Oh, jeez, it's everywhere, isn't it?
Well, now this is really an interesting story, and I hope out of all of this, maybe the bees are going to end up, hopefully we're going to be able to save the bees, and this whole process, the bees are going to save us humans. The Danish minister, they decided that they would do some testing, and this is a quote here. Against all expectations, sieving down, that means going down through the soil and polluting the groundwater, they found at a rate 5 times more than was allowed for the level of drinking water by this Roundup herbicide.
It was
5 times. Now, when we spray glyphosate, remember that's when Dr. Gurian Sherman was talking about that in the first interview. When glyphosate, when we spray glyphosate on the fields, by the rules, the regulations, it has been shown that it washed down into the upper groundwater with a concentration of 0.54 micrograms per liter. This is very surprising because we had previously believed that bacteria in the soil broke down the glyphosate before it reached the groundwater, unquote. George, in every direction, things that were expected are not happening the way they thought.
Stay with us. Linda Moulton Howe will now take your phone calls wide open. Conversations with Linda in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie in the cave in St. Louis. We'll be right back. Well, here in St. Louis, it was just 1, 11, and 11 seconds. I can't get away from those numbers. Linda, anything new to that story that you were checking into about what could have been a UFO buried under the sands of Utah? Remember that one?
Yes, and like so many other in the UFO phenomena that dissolve into confusion and attacks and all of that, the whole point of that research was to follow up on a man in California who had been there 2 or 3 times, had known people who had climbed down into the basement of one of those buildings and found this log, these log diaries and the satellite image, which does exist. There was this huge triangle there and is still there today, somewhat eroded. But back in the 1953, June 11th, 1953 time period, why was this gigantic, very defined, huge triangle there out in what is called the Dress Facility area? And the fact that there were citizens that I interviewed, many of them, I talked to 20, 30 people. Some of them had been around in 53 in that period of time, and they remembered about all of the UFO sightings. And there was this historic context for that report. Well, since doing the report and the man in California providing all the material, others have come forward and they're attacking the details of it. And from my point of view as a reporter, this is the kind of a story that needs somebody else to come with a lot of money and do the kind of aerial magnetometer surveys.
Yes.
And those sort of things that those of us that have humble lives cannot do. But there are people who certainly, if they have interest, could back up a follow-up, take this research and develop it further. But like so many things, it seems to just dissolve into bickering.
Well, knowing you with your guts, Linda, you'd be out there with a shovel.
Probably.
Let's go to the phones. We'll go to our wild card line. You're on the air with Linda Moulton Howe. Hi there.
Hi.
Welcome to the show. Where are you calling from? Yeah.
Okay, this is Angela. I'm calling from Covington, Louisiana.
All right, Angela, go ahead.
I was, Linda, by the way, I love your newsletter on the computer.
Oh, it's a new website. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering because I have what I believe is that skin condition.
Oh, Magellan's.
And also, I was wondering, could there be a connection? Because I think it comes from contact with insecticides. And I'm wondering, could there be a connection between the honeybees, the skin conditions that are showing up, and also the, not the Alzheimer's, but, you know, the other, the disease that's in I've got a senior minute, excuse me.
Like Alzheimer's for people?
Alzheimer's, but with the children, my little nephew's got now, you know, that
ADD?
All those type of things. That's right.
Well, you're asking a question that a lot of people are beginning to ask, I think, not just in the United States, but all over the world who have some concern about Earth life, and that is there are a lot of syndromes, and there are a lot of animal extinctions, and now there is this issue with pollinators. We can't seem to get a paper trail on what the government is or is not doing, let's say with chemtrails. We can't seem to get any honest assertion on a lot of fronts about what kind of pollution might be going on in our water, in our air, because it might threaten corporate profit bottom lines. There is so much of that in this world now, and it is the health of people and the planet that really does take a back seat, unfortunately, to net profit sheets. And I think that one of the frustrations is that there are a lot of problems and that perhaps the answers are often hidden in this issue of trying to understand what could be happening to the honeybees. What I have been learning from people, unfortunately, so far, largely off the record, about how much has been suppressed and that more and more people are beginning to dig out the bad laboratory links. One just recently, this is one that can be talked about publicly, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace prevailed in a court case that involved Russia, a Russian lab, and now this is another one of the question marks. Did that Russian lab have a link to Monsanto in the United States, and is that why their research on Monsanto genetically modified potatoes that killed rats, was it suppressed for 8 years on purpose because Monsanto did not want to be embarrassed? That appears to be the implication, and what has happened is the suit that Greenpeace prevailed was simply getting the lab report made public. Can you believe this? And the lab report is saying essentially that these genetically modified potatoes were inedible for any life form. Now, this is not said as an attack on that corporation or anybody else's corporation, but this is a fact that it came out in a court that was published, that there was an effort to suppress data about genetically modified food. That is the fact. You can't go beyond that. You can say, okay, if that happened in that research on those genetically modified potatoes, how much other research with damaging implications are also being hidden from us.
Okay, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hey, this is Bob from Miami. George, what an honor. And Linda, thank you for informing us on this very pertinent issue. If I may say so, I'd like to go and first touch upon the chemtrails and mention that I have been aware of a researcher that has found barium in the chemtrails, and I wondered if that may be a link. And one more thing, rather than seeking Osama bin Laden, I wondered if maybe others who are listening thought that it's a conspiracy for population control. George, I know you mentioned this to her on the last program, and Alex Jones talks about this, and they're trying to put us in a police state, or they're going to put us in some camps, and this would be a perfect opportunity to start controlling our food sources and whatnot. And by the way, I just really appreciate it. Thanks for letting me say what I wanted to say.
Well, okay, thank you. Thank you for thinking. They're all good questions, but I would say that the larger argument is that it is against the corporate interests of the United States, and it is against national security, and it is against the interests of any sitting presidential administration to have the food supply to the United States of America in the hands of China or Brazil or any other country.
It's amazing how it's doing a flip-flop where we used to be the ones controlling the world's food supply.
And you heard Jerry Hayes talk about the USDA projected estimate that some 40% of our vegetables, our fruits, and all of this could be coming from China in another 15 or 20 years.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing.
I can't my rational left brain mind says it makes no sense for the corporate greed, military-industrial complex to have the food supplies of the United States dependent upon potential enemies. Therefore, I would say that whatever is happening to the pollinators of North America, it may be related to pollution, contamination, and a whole complex series of things that part of what we talked about tonight and other things that we still don't know anything about. But I do not think at this point that there would be any reason to suggest that this government was trying to affect this. This would be truly cutting off your nose to spite your face. And when I've talked with some scientists and others about the Osama bin Laden al-Qaeda connection to long-time connection to the honeybee trade in the Middle East, people are aware, and I did have an interview that was quite difficult because the person did not want to comment. And when I realized how difficult they were being and knew that it was because they didn't want to say, and I know their role and I know what they do, it says to me that our government is looking at the possibility of some sort of outside influence. However, I would think right now, just based on tonight is one facet of a real problem that is developing in this country and other countries having to do with pesticides, herbicides, and all of that. There are already known links that tie contamination in water through herbicides, such as Roundup, to the deaths of amphibians. That's been established. So we know that there are dominoes falling out in the world in isolated cases that link directly to contamination, chemical contamination. I think that this story and the science, a lot of scientists, even though they can't say anything on the record, no one can say this is the answer because they don't. They just don't have a bottom line.
Nobody knows.
But the whole question of the chemistry of this planet now, the complexity of it, and when you talk about these nicotine-based pesticides that can interfere with a bee's memory, combined with certain fungicides, expands, or that was the word, synergizes the toxic effect 1,000 times over its experimental use in the lab. My Lord. And these are things that are just being discovered. So I think at the top of, near the top of the list of candidates for several problems, and the woman asked also about Morgellons. This is still a problem. It is out there. I get emails all the time. I know that there are really hardworking people trying to understand what this strange thing is that is affecting a lot of people having these projections of. That's the question. That's still not clear. What are these fibrils coming through people's skin? And you can step back and say, all right, there are a lot of things affecting humans, affecting amphibians, pollinators, birds. Birds are dying all over the place. And there's a lot that's off and wrong for everything on this planet. And then you get to the question of global warming. Are the changes in temperatures that are beginning now to form a very, very clear pattern? We just had NOAA announce this 2006 December to February 2007 is the single warmest average global temperature on record for the world. Never been that warm in those months ever before since humans have been keeping records.
Worldwide.
And this is a constant trend that there has not been any year in which the temperature average has been going down. It has been constantly climbing. And what this is beginning to show also on very clear biodiversity maps is that moisture, temperature, desertification, they are changing. The ocean surface temperatures are changing. And when all of that gets put together, there was one of the most interesting articles that came out from Stanford just this week, and it was entitled Crops Feel the Heat as the World Warms. And I underlined a particular paragraph, and it was a surprise. It said that scientists now, working at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and with Food and Agricultural Organization, with the UN and Stanford and a whole lot of places, that they have found on average that the global yields for several crops went down the warmer the temperature became, and that with the yields dropped by about 5% for every 1 degree Fahrenheit increase. This surprised scientists, and you know, that does not bode well for a planet that is projected to warm maybe as much as 10 or 11 degrees Fahrenheit over the next 90 years. What will happen to crops and pollinators and Earth life if you start finding that you can't get a handle on a control even on what's happening to crops? And on top of this, one of the scientists I talked to brought up a very interesting point. The president just got back from a meeting down in Brazil. There was an agreement. We are supposed to now in the United States, we're going to start trying to make huge acreages growing crops for ethanol. Well, if we use whatever it's going to be, corn or sunflower seeds or whatever, and we start competing our food-growing soils with soils that are going to be allocated for energy, and that depending upon what they spray and how large these fields become for energy, not food, what is that going to do to the balance of nature that is clearly off balance now and affecting the pollinators?
True. I know a few years ago the American Corn Growers Association claimed that they could provide all the feed they needed and ethanol, but I'm not sure that's the case anymore. I'm also surprised, Linda, that the supposed mastermind of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, hasn't taken responsibility for all the dying or missing honeybees because he has taken responsibility for every other terrorist act.
Do you believe that guy?
There's something fishy there, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, the caller's other question about the possibility of population control, though as far-fetched as it may seem, you know what? I don't rule anything out anymore, Linda.
But the corporate greed people need the populations to purchase to keep their hamster cages going and their profit line expanding. It's a terrible world we're in now because everything is being driven by the wrong priorities.
Linda, stay with us. When we come back, we're going to take final phone calls with you. I can't believe 2 hours with you have already buzzed by this quickly. If you need to get to any of Linda's work, that's earthfiles.com. You can email her, at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And in my particular case, you can email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. And then next hour, for the next 2 hours, we'll have our Friday into Saturday morning open lines and a special hotline for crazy stories. But I'll have to explain that first. I'll be back in a moment. Final phone calls, conversations with Linda on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. We're with Linda Moulton Howe. Let's go back to the phones. Wildcard Line, you're on with Linda. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's a pleasure listening to you.
Well, thank you so much.
You're so fantastic, and I love Linda.
Thank you.
Linda, I have a couple questions for you. I live out in the country here near Hershey, Pennsylvania, and I noticed even on my little country roads, there's not enough milkweed for the monarch butterflies. And the chicory is getting scarce because I use chicory. I dry the herb, the root, and I grind it up and put it in coffee. And, you know, and these pesticides, I'm very concerned. I have a background in biology, and I was wondering if they, you know, the more they apply and then they reapply a different herbicide or pesticide, these two could combine to form a different pesticide. In other words, you take two pesticides, and if you spray one on top of the other, they can produce a third.
That's right. That's what that synergy comment was about. And the fact that they found that the fungicide mixed with that neonicotinoid would exacerbate or increase the dynamic of the impact by 1,000 times over its toxic ability in the lab, that is really, that's really something, actually.
Well, I feel that it might be a fungicide that's killing off the bees, because a fungus would be the easiest thing for to grow in a hive. So, I mean, I had a bee fly in on my sun porch the other day, and I looked at the poor thing, and I said, what's happening to your society? You know, I mean, I felt so sorry for the bee.
Right.
And we should feel sorry for ourselves, because what affects them comes up the food chain.
That's right.
And we're the top of the food chain.
Well, and as Jerry Hayes said, he looks at, after a long life of working with bees, he looks at them as a canary in the coal mine and says, this is happening to the bees. Maybe this is a warning to humans. Many people have been saying that, and that there is something really out of whack, out of balance in the environment that is causing this problem.
Right.
I wonder how many of you, including George, knew that the National Academy of Sciences last year had a meeting with other scientists and agency people in Washington specifically on the issue of the rapid decline of all pollinators in North America. That is not something that was blasted around on the 6 o'clock news, and it it should have been.
They don't tell us anything on the news. That's why I listen to George Norrie, because you find out where earthquakes are, you find out where volcanic eruptions are, you find out all this on Coast to Coast.
And I hope that
And I guess you find out where you can stick your head in the sand and hide from all this, too. Huh?
No, George, I hope and pray that everybody learns to live in harmony with our planet, Mother Earth, and because she feeds us.
Yeah.
And,
if they don't learn to live in harmony with her, we are in for a very big havoc future.
Yeah, and I hope that you and all the Coast listeners will also visit earthfiles.com, because that is my goal, reporting and editing a news website that is focused around science, environment, and real X files, and trying to report hard facts about subjects that should be on the network 6 o'clock news and for the most part are not, and may be the subjects that affect all of us the very most. So I hope you will all go to earthfiles.com, and I will have a very interesting report up either after I'm off of Coast tonight or by tomorrow morning if the server is fixed, and it will include some very interesting photographs, maps, and this list with hard links to all of these various apiary honeybee websites that you can all go to learn more And then if you have something happening in your area, you can communicate to people who are trying to study this seriously. So, and for those who have something that you think might be linked to the pollinator decline in your region that may not be reaching the news, if you will please email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Think of a reporter filing news about the earth, and it is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. I would very much like to hear from people about what might be happening in your community concerning honeybees and all of the pollinators.
You know, Linda, you look at all the drama shows on television and what they have in the movies. Real life is the most dramatic of all of it.
Always has been. That's why Earth Mysteries, to me, is the most fascinating subject that you can possibly begin to get into. The world is so far stranger. Who was it? It was one of the great writers who said that the universe is far stranger than anybody could ever imagine. I think it was Shakespeare, one of those lines. But and along the issue of remarkable things happening, a footnote on the honeybees that I learned just tonight. And this gives you a feeling of why that Mr. Van Engelsdorp said to me this afternoon that this is an emergency situation on the honeybees. There is a beekeeper in the Texas area, and he had marked his hives 4 weeks ago, George, 4 weeks ago. That was mid-February. We're at March 16th.
Yep.
And he put numbers on them. And when he put the numbers on them, it was specifically because he wanted to track the health, and he wanted to have a number system on his hive. And 4 weeks ago, they were all healthy, full. He said you couldn't have had a healthier colony. And right now, of the numbers, he used specifically, he said, the one I marked number 9, Linda, it's completely gone in 4 weeks. Now, this means what others have said, whatever this is, it happens rapidly. It's not going away. And when it hits, the collapse, that colony collapse, the colony is going from what appears to be vigorous health and collapses as rapidly as 4 weeks and is completely gone.
Linda, as we unfold this incredible story, it is also going to be fascinating to see, and I hope not, if anything happens physically to any of these beekeepers. Is that a possibility?
Nobody has brought that up yet. It hasn't come up. I don't know of a case of a beekeeper being affected. And what you would mean, if it was related to pesticides, would there be anything about the hives themselves that would be toxic enough to people to pick up?
Yep.
I'm not aware of anything like that happening, but they do know that when they air out these hives, it can be days or week, maybe even longer, then those, what they call the pests or the predators, those wax moths and the beetles, will move into the deserted hives finally, and they will go after the honey and the whatever pollen and nectar is in there. And that is intriguing because you would think then that the beetles and the wax moths would die from whatever it was that caused the honeybees to go away. But I want to stress something that only became clear to me tonight in talking with the beekeeper who had 13,000 hives and has lost 96% of them have disappeared. He said, when you have what they call the flat board in a hive, if you have a disease or if you have mice, you find dead bodies on that flat board. And he said, you open up the hives with this phenomenon that's occurring. He says, it's clean. Everything is clean. That is the weird part. And Mr. Van Engelsdorp brought up something today. He said another part of this, why he's not convinced it's pesticides and why he's not convinced that it's a lot of things. He said, we're finding that there can be colony collapse of, let's say, 80% of the colony, all these hives, and 100 feet away are more hives of the same beekeeper in the same colony, and they are healthy and untouched. You said, how can this be? And this is giving you some of the reasons why. This is just really frustrating to everybody who's trying to study it.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us. Thanks for holding.
Rather than beat a dead horse, we're playing a bad case of Jenga in a spherical sense with our delicate nature here. I think we're running out of time, and I think that 111 thing is telling us, the reason why that keeps popping up is it's saying, hey, folks, we don't have much more time to turn this around. If we don't do something now, we're going to lose it all. And it's all collapsing in on us.
Yes, I would agree with you. And it is part now, it's becoming like an umbrella theme song, an inconvenient truth at so many levels on this planet of so many environmental warning bells going off. And an inconvenient truth is the title of the documentary that won the Academy Award that started out as Al Gore's slideshow on global warming. And now there are inconvenient truths that are prevalent everywhere. And another one of these that is a kind of a sidebar, perhaps, and may or may not turn out to be directly related to what's happening with the pollinators. But just in the last couple of years in India, when the people have gone out to harvest cotton, the genetically modified crops are focused in certain crops. Cotton is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
These are cotton collectors who have been working in India for centuries, right? I mean, not the same person, but the whole concept of people in India going out into the fields and harvesting cotton has been going on for...
Of course, they believe in reincarnation. Maybe it is the same person.
Well, but they have found just in the advent of the genetically modified cotton that people break out with horrible rashes, terrible allergic coughs. People in India who have not gone to doctors before are going to doctors with allergic reactions to collecting cotton. And this is so puzzling, because why is it that the genetically modified cotton plant would be any radically different from a naturally evolved cotton plant? Well, this is a program that I would like to do at some point in the future, is specifically about what exactly does happen with genetically engineered crops. And one of the things that I've been learning is there is a author, Jeffrey Smith. He's got a new book that'll be out in April. It's called Genetic Roulette. He's the author of Seeds of Deception. And he lays out very clearly that when you go into the genome sequencing of, let's say, a corn plant DNA, and you want to insert a gene that's going to be resistant to an herbicide, you're not just like, as he says, like in Legos, you aren't neatly inserting one piece in between two other pieces. They are now finding that there's destruction on either side in the DNA sequencing where that gene is inserted. Well, what does that destruction in the process of trying to put a gene in do? And this is the world that is apparently so not understood, that we're taking for granted that these are scientifically precise procedures, and they may not be, that there may be unexpected consequences from trying to insert one gene. And when you realize that some of the genetically modified research includes something like this, you take a gene from a spider that is involved with the making of silk from the spider's point of view,
mm-hmm.
and you insert it into a plant with the idea that the plant will then be able to produce these fibers, not from the spider, but in the plant
on its own,
that you harvest for Kevlar or military vests.
Jeez.
Okay, now that's why it sometimes is called Frankenstein crops and Frankenstein weeds. Well, the motivation might be a good motivation. It may not have anything to do with original negative intent. But I think that what all of this is beginning to boil down to, the pollinators dying off, the birds dying off, the amphibians dying off, the oceans are changing, everything is changing, is that we humans have gotten to a point where we are manipulating now, even at the genetic level, in ways that have such unexpected consequences that we do not know what we are doing, and we are not going to know what we're doing. There will not be a scientist on this planet who will know the consequences until time runs on, and then there may be too much damage. And that seems to be the rickety place, not only for where are we with pesticides, where are we with genetically modified crops, and where are we with a growing CO2 blanket around this planet that is warming it. This is independent of any speculation about the sun. We have a blanket, and it's getting thicker around this planet, and the projection is, no matter what, this Earth is going to continue to warm up in this century, again, with unexpected consequences.
And it's not nice to fool Mother Nature, is it, Linda?
Well, I think that we children of God have a lot of lessons to learn.
We might have time for one more quick question. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, my name is Sharon, and I keep bees as a hobbyist.
Okay.
And I live very rural, and my bees are actually doing quite well, but I'm at a very high altitude, and it's very clean up here. There's no pesticides. There's no... I live in the wilderness.
You are one of the lucky ones. It hasn't gotten to you yet, Sharon, but you know what? A few months ago, there were some beekeepers that were saying that, Linda.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Yes, and are you saying that so far in your isolation, you're seeing that your bees are remaining quite healthy?
So far, so good for her, and she claims that she's up high enough away, but I don't know if you can hide from whatever is happening to these honeybees.
Well, that's what we're going to see this summer, and let's pray, all of us, that the bees are somehow, with spring and summer coming on, as few as there are, that they might, with new pollen and new nectar that may not be as contaminated as whatever happened in the fall of 2006, in the summer of 2006, maybe the bees are going to be able to turn around. If not, like Dave Hackenberg said, we could be with food shortages at the end of 2007.
Thank you, Linda. Appreciate you being on the program.
Thank you.
I always wonder if a bee will just do as much as it has to do, or just clocks out whenever, you know, it thinks it's finished. Do they pick up the slack of the other bees now who aren't around? That's an interesting possibility. 2 hours of open lines up next on Coast to Coast AM.